Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Muslim women are often the focus of debate when it comes to public conversations about Islam. Much of this centers on feelings and assumptions surrounding an object, the veil. Rafia Zakaria, journalist and author, unravels the complex nexus of attitudes, policies, and histories revolving around this object in her fascinating new book, Veil. She demonstrates how the object can serve as a moral delineator, a disciplinary measure, a signifier of goodness, or as a means to subvert or rebel social norms. Through personal narratives and detailed analysis of various social and political conditions, Zakaria offers an engaging and nuanced assessment of the veil in the contemporary context. In our conversation, we discuss notions of the exotic Orient, colonization, representations in photography and painting, prostitution, veiling in legal contexts, public aesthetics, violence, forms of feminism, contextual meaning-making, and much, much more. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Rafia Zakaria about Veil, published by Bloomsbury's Object Lessons series in 2017.
Welcome, Rafia. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
So thanks for joining us here on New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm excited to talk to you about this wonderful book titled Veil. But before we get into the book, we always start with a little bit about the author. So could you give us a little bit of background on your writing in general, where you see your book Veil fitting into kind of your larger projects as an author?
Yes. So I am originally from Karachi, from Pakistan. And, I grew up there and then I had an arranged marriage, came to the U.S. And then, went to college and then graduate school and et cetera here. And, in terms of right now, I'm a journalist. I do mostly opinion writing. My other book is The Upstairs Wife, An Intimate History of Pakistan, which is kind of a feminist history, Pakistani history told through the eyes of women, the central focus being the women in my family. I've been working on issues facing Muslim women, issues of the veil, issues of the way Muslim women are framed within a popular discourse, and then, larger issues surrounding terrorism, foreign aid. So yeah, I have a pretty wide kind of ambit, but most of my long form writing, the books have focused and continue to focus on just on Muslim women and try to sort of combat or provide an antidote to the very monolithic construction of Muslim women as either victims or pawns or escapees from their culture. And that is definitely kind of the larger ideological or philosophical project that informs my writing, is to inflect some complexity in an otherwise persistent portrait of Muslim women as as persecuted and hence awaiting saviors.
And you certainly achieve that in this book. It's nuanced kind of interweaving of your own kind of personal narrative with broader kind of social context from various places. I'm wondering if you could kind of set us up with how this book kind of emerged as it kind of appears today. And what, so it's in this Object Lesson series. Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to this series and why did you want to write this book within it, as opposed to perhaps, another kind of personal social history or something?
Yes. The Object Lesson series is, it's a series of books written, not all of them are written by academics, but a fair number of them are. And, the editors are academics, of the series. And, they kind of, are little histories of objects that are otherwise not considered in isolation, or haven't gotten attention. So it's this, the larger sort of philosophical framework of Object Lessons is that, objects themselves have kind of a literary, artistic, and history, and that they influence the non-objects, so they influence humans and other living life in a way that isn't often considered. They can define space. They can, provide constrictions or expansions. And so it's this idea of taking the objects seriously as indicators of our cultural or historical narratives at large. And and there's of course like a aesthetic an element of aesthetic critique within the Object Lesson series, because of course it relies on this central, the aesthetics of objects as informing their meaning. And so I was attracted to this for a number of reasons. First, of course, is that I wanted to disengage the veil from, from as being sort of just like this attachment that, that exists and is attached to Muslim women, it's the meaning that it adds to the person who wears the veil is not often considered separate from that person or the politics of that person. And the other reason was to sort of bring these considerations of the veil and of Islam and Muslim women within this aesthetic sphere where it's divested from, the most sort of common or, the idea of the veil is that, okay, is the veil within Islam? The debate is on whether is the veil required or not required, and then within Western societies where Muslims are a minority, it's always the, again, it's, is it required, not required, or, the women who wear the veil are ones that are more interested in assimilation, and then the ones who wear it are obviously interested in sort of maintaining this sequestered identity. And so I wanted to take it a little bit out of that, those sort of the routine conversations, and consider it also as an aesthetic object that has a reality of its own, and that does different things to issues of identity and anonymity beyond sort of like this very central religious idea of the whale. So, you know, so the book doesn't, for instance, go at length about, not that those debates are not important, but, I wanted to expand that question from is the whale required or not required? Should we allow it or not allow it, etc., into this idea that the whale has an artistic and aesthetic history also that is unexplored, and that, you know, is connected to the historical and political meanings, but is not necessarily discussed as often. So, yeah, so those were some of the kind of larger philosophical or, you know, dialectical concerns that I was interested in. But then on a purely personal, level, I was also very motivated by the questions that I faced personally about the whale and the sort of very multidimensional uses in that I've seen the whale being put to, or the meanings attached to the whale impose. And they're not sort of the typical, they don't follow the typical assumptions. And so, you know, when you're a Muslim woman and people ask you, well, why do you wear this or why don't you wear this? You have this moment of pause, you know, where you're trying to think about how you could possibly explain the complexity of that question and your experience in relation to it. And this book, you know, is kind of my condensed response to that sort of, to these questions about, okay, why or what is the whale, or what are your thoughts on the whale? So here you go, you know, here are my thoughts on the whale and like a sort of compendium of my experiences and how they connect to like the larger aesthetics of the whale.
Yeah. And I think it makes it a really interesting read, and certainly one that kind of complicates the kind of various texts that are out there on issues of veiling. One of the things you begin with in the book is this tension between perhaps independence and constraint that you were kind of examined through two moments in your life. So you talk about kind of a moment in your early school days and then a moment from your wedding to sort of reveal the intersections between object and agency. Can you kind of talk a little bit about how you saw these events in your life kind of revealing certain things about desires and decisions and constraints?
Yes, absolutely. One of the reasons that I wanted to intersperse, you know, my own experiences along with this discussion is because I think that, as a Muslim, I do feel pressure to sort of, you know, I wish people were more sort of attuned or informed about things related to Muslim culture and sort of the inner workings of Muslim society. But, you know, you don't always have that. And I do think that personal stories, and in that way, I was lucky with this book because I was given really kind of a wide berth in terms of how I wanted to take this, where I wanted to take this narrative, and how much, how academic it would be or how personal it would be was really entirely up to me, which for a writer is just, you know, fantastic. you know, the example that you talk about, and it was also, I excerpted, I think it's in the Paris Review, was the same. And it starts in the rebellion chapter, and it talks about this picnic. Well, first of all, it talks about the fact that, you know, I went to a school where in Karachi, where it was all girls, and, you know, we were there were no men around. Really. And every morning we would go in and, you know, we had to be there by 8 o'clock. And then at 8 o'clock, the gates were locked and we were in there. And this kind of all female world until the afternoon. And so that story in particular is about this one time where my class was going on a picnic, which was to the beach, which was a huge deal, as you can imagine, because if you're, and I must add that the locked in portion, I mean, it sounds kind of, you know, sinister, or sounds like cruel, but we never felt like we were locked in. It was a huge school with huge grounds, and so you know, we didn't have a feeling of being constrained, because you know, we had a lot of freedom inside, and we were at school, so it was a very big deal. And I had been talking on the phone without permission to some, you know, random boy that had passed his number to me, and and I had mentioned this picnic, which was, it was taking place at a private beach, so you couldn't, you know, it wasn't like a regular beach, of course, since, you know, otherwise the girls would not get permission from their families to go, you know, to a public beach by themselves, and even fully clothed and fully veiled, they would not get that permission. So anyway, we go off to this private beach. I've mentioned this to this, and I never ever thought that I didn't think anyone could come in there. So here we are at this beach, and, you know, as in the Muslim world, you know, everyone goes to the beach, but we go to the beach fully clothed, and as we were that day, with our teachers and snacks and all the rest of it, having fun. And then a boat, a speed boat, essentially pulls up to the beach, and it has, you know, a bunch of, oh my God, boys in it. And in that very segregated society, this was just like a catastrophe, a complete catastrophe. And of course, they, not only did they come, they were shouting my name, which outs me as the person who essentially catalyzed this catastrophe and brought it on to everybody. And so, you know, following this event, I was just, you know, I faced a lot of consequences. I was really ostracized, which within, you know, this kind of small insulated world of the school was very, very difficult. And so what I started to do to show kind of that I was repentant of this behavior was that I started to wear a headscarf or a veil. Now, and that excerpt from the book talks about how kind of redundant this was, because I was wearing this veil mostly inside school. And inside school, there were no men. So the veil, you know, in that context, didn't it didn't really have, I mean, it signified sort of repentance and like turning over a new leaf. But it wasn't attached to kind of the usual meaning. It was entirely for women, you know, which were my audience then. That is one of the sort of pivotal kind of incidences that I talk about, in Veil, because it shows that this is an object that conveys a kind of a meaning that is, I mean, there's a separate meaning, but there's also a deeply contextual meaning, that exists within, not even just within a society, but within the very kind of small conversation that was taking place, you know, with my friends and teachers in this all-girls school. And it sort of signifies a return to some or a repentance of a kind of action and a different sort of person. Like you've changed and you're not going to do that, you know, talking out your class and their picnic location anymore.
Now, you also look very closely at this equivalence between the veil and moral goodness. And you look at this through kind of several examples from your own life, kind of in markets, in lobbies, hotel lobbies, through your own college experience, and then even into your professional career. You've seen some of these kind of debates play out. What were you trying to get at in this chapter? What were you trying to tell us through some of these examples?
The point that you bring up, the central issue of the veil signifying purity or moral goodness or a certain kind of femininity, is definitely, you know, that's kind of like the meaning that the social meaning that's attached, at least in Muslim countries and in Pakistan in particular. And the examples that I have in the book are examples, for instance, that show how women are aware of that and can and are strategic in deploying that as a foil to sort of constraints on their actions. So I think one of the examples in the book is in a hotel lobby. So now you're in a hotel lobby, you want, and you know, you pick a hotel lobby in Karachi for a lot of reasons, but one of them is the fact that they're air conditioned and there's like a, I mean, it's not a private space, but it's a semi-private space, right? So it's not as public as the street. And, you know, if you want to meet a boy that you've been talking to or that you're interested in over there, then wearing a veil is a way to essentially hide your identity while you're on that date, because being seen, you know, and there are loads of examples of this sort of thing that happen, and it's really not even it's not a news flash in, at least in Pakistan, that you would do that, because in case someone, I mean, you know, you see someone, even someone that you don't know, there, it's a way essentially that you can kind of hide and do this thing that would otherwise is kind of, at least among very, very conservative Pakistanis, is something questionable, is meeting a boy by yourself. And then, of course, there are like complete other extremes of that too, where, there are instances in Karachi and actually in other parts of the Muslim world, in Cairo and other places, where women who are sex workers will wear full veils while they are out, at public bus stops and other locations like that, where they can see if they're propositioned, and the men know and the women know, but oftentimes they are veiled. And it's a strategic deployment, because it it's almost like within those contexts that you can have, like, it's like a way of creating a private space for yourself, you know, like a pod, and increasingly that use is more and more common, because the nature of urbanization in the Muslim world, it's very rapid, and it's such that people don't have private spaces within which to have private conversations, and women are, for those reasons, increasingly out in these public spaces. And it's not always, to do sort of morally questionable thing. It's also to sort of expand the ambit of their freedom. So I think, one of the incidences that I start the book with is women, is me in a hospital waiting room in Karachi, where I'm fully covered and my head is covered, but I was unveiled, and I spent like a couple of days watching another woman there who was fully veiled. Her face was uncovered, but otherwise. And I saw how much more freely she could operate within that space, both in terms of kind of the space she occupied, I'm kind of like building forts on either side with like plastic bags or, tote bags or whatever, so that I can kind of have enough space to sit and not kind of have someone in my personal space. But she didn't have to do that, because it's almost like if there's a veiled woman, there's more respect for the space that she occupies. And so she was far freer in that space, in her, when she's talking on the phone and in her actions, and is able to kind of evade the sort of male gaze that otherwise, in Pakistan, it never leaves you, and never stops making you feel very uncomfortable. So that was definitely an example where she knew this and she was using it to her advantage. And women do that frequently. I mean, in workplaces, in Pakistan and in other parts of the Muslim world, it's the same thing. It signifies a sort of seriousness of intent and purpose, where, I'm wearing this, which means that I'm not here to flirt with you. I'm not here because, I think this is fun. I'm here to work. And, it kind of signifies that can signify that within those contexts.
And this kind of notion of the veil as a moral delineator, in one example, from a trip to Cairo, you kind of look at some of the everyday consequences of this disagreement of whether the veil is required or not, and what exactly that means. But it's also, I think, a really interesting example of how these debates foster or reinforce the authority of men. Could you talk a little bit about this example and why you brought this into the conversation?
Yes, and you know, I mean, on a purely personal level, I wanted to write about it because it was at the time that it happened, it shook me and upset me so much because of the work. I mean, I'm someone who writes about Muslim women and my experiences of other women that I work with. I'm a lawyer. I worked for quite a while on a project that gave Muslim women, provided legal assistance to Muslim women facing domestic violence situations, and also sort of, you know, done a lot of work on having Muslim women's rights respected within American court systems. So with that background, but I don't cover my hair. And so on this trip to Cairo, there was, I was part of a delegation of academics and, journalists who were visiting Cairo. And this is a while ago. So this is right after, so it must be 2010 or 2011. It was right after President Obama was elected and had given his speech at Cairo University. And, so we went to visit it's almost like a digital website that they ran, for Muslim issues and providing kind of guidance on various questions on Islam. And this happened more than once. So it happened there. It also happened at Cairo University, where the women who were wearing headscarves very bluntly kind of accused me of not being Muslim because I wasn't wearing the headscarf. So it was very much kind of this attitude that, you know, you've picked the American side instead of the Muslim side, and because you're not wearing the headscarf, or somehow being in the West has diluted your faith and your desire to practice the, you know, quote, air quotes, true Islam. And and the reaction of the men there was very telling, because I mean, there's a smugness there about, you know, the fact that a woman who doesn't cover her hair is a lesser Muslim. And then, of course, there were it was interesting to see the reaction of some of the American Muslim men who had been part of our delegation, who very quickly started to sort of take up for this idea that yes, a veil is required, and in a sort of way that they would not have done in the United States. And it's almost kind of like, now that they were in a Muslim country, they felt like they could sort of, you know, lay down the law without any kind of apologetics, that they were telling women what to do. And it just really shook me to the core, because, like I said, first of all, of the work that I do, and second of all, because I felt like there was a sort of eagerness to take on this very patriarchal idea of interpreting Islam in a certain way, and then telling women that they had to do it so if they were going to be considered Muslim. And and it was very disconcerting. I mean, you know, there isn't sort of, obviously, that I don't offer any resolution to this question. Or even situations like that in the book, because I didn't get one. In a way, the book was my process for trying to sort that out, or at least articulate it, so that other women who face that, that pressure to prove their piety by a public act, can understand that, first of all, that they're not alone. And then for non-Muslim readers or, you know, people who teach about veil or veiling or Muslim societies or cultures, they can kind of show that this isn't, you know, there isn't an answer that you can find in a book about this. There are, you know, very kind of interpretive disagreements about that answer, and also in interpretive disagreements about who gets to decide what the answer is for any individual Muslim woman. And I think, you know, for too long, at least within the American, I mean, not just American Muslims, but Muslims in general, they're, you know, in this post 9/11 kind of moment where pretty much any Muslim, particularly any Muslim living in the West, faces this, you know, faces this pressure to constantly explain Islam, or and particularly issues like the veil, that we have to kind of come up with these bullet point answers and present this kind of very united front, so that kind of we can be accepted and we can defend ourselves or whatever. And I completely disagree with that approach. And that incident kind of illustrated that for me, because, or what I hoped illustrated that for my readers, because it shows that no, Muslims are not at all united on most questions, and that sort of plurality is very much and has been historically a part of Islam and Islamic history, and that it needs to be recognized and understood. So, you know, the response to this kind of monolithic construction of Muslims as violent and repressive and, you know, is not that, or shouldn't be, in my view, this idea that Muslims are united and there are these pat answers to the questions, and yes, the veil is required for all Muslim women. That is not the response, you know. So insisting on unity is definitely not the response. And so, you know, I wanted to take that incident and you know, this issue, very contentious issue of veiling, and, you know, and kind of present the fact that no, we're absolutely not united. And there are complex factors that go into how you answer that question for yourself as a Muslim, you know, as a Muslim woman. And there is a backlash to that, to my attitude, because, you know, yes, I mean, in responses to read from readers, I've seen that, you know, there are Western readers who are dissatisfied because they want to go to a book and they want the book to tell them what to think about the veil. And ideally, that, you know, yes, the veil is very repressive and it should be banned. So then they can kind of be affirmed in their prejudice. And then there are also, you know, some, you know, Muslims and Muslim women who think that the veil is required for everyone, and that women who are not veiling are, you know, they are sort of legitimate in judging them as lesser Muslims because they're not veiling. And so there, you know, I recognize that I was kind of like trying to find a not pleasing either of those extremes. And, but, you know, I mean, hopefully that there are other readers who can see the value in that.
Another aspect of the book that I really thought kind of filled out this multi-dimensionality that you kind of frame the book with in the beginning, are these various legal cases and legal contexts where veiling kind of signifies different things. Can you talk about some of these, perhaps the case of Rachel Dawson, who some listeners may be familiar with, but probably many are not, or this case in Canada? What are the kind of factors that we need to consider in these legal discussions?
Yeah, you know, the Rachel Dawson case from Finsbury Park Mosque in London, I mean, when I read it, I was just, and it's Rebecca Dawson, but, and you know, that's fine.
That's, sorry.
No problem. Is that I felt that that case really kind of showed or upended this idea that, the dispute behind it was also kind of related to the same larger issue that I just talked about in terms of, you know, who, like how much interaction with the larger communities and assimilation and all of these questions. So in this case, you know, there was the backdrop of the case is that in the Finsbury Park Mosque, there was an ongoing power struggle between people who wanted to open the mosque to visitors who could, you know, kind of walk through a mosque or kind of be taken on a little tour where they could learn more about about Islam or see what's inside a mosque, really basically to kind of, you know, combat this idea that the mosque is like this secret place where Muslims meet to plot terror, you know, which is unfortunately the sort of boogeyman kind of picture of Islam that has been created by popular media and mainstream media in the West. So, but, you know, so there were people who wanted to do this and there were others who didn't. And Rebecca Dawson's husband was one of the people, you know, who kind of got into a tussle with someone else over this issue. He didn't think that this should be happening. And the other kind of side did. And Rebecca Dawson's husband then got arrested because he beat up a caretaker volunteer, you know, and it was about, again, it was, I mean, there was an issue of covering because the visitors that had been taken through the mosque had not been properly, you know, didn't have their arms and legs covered or their heads covered. And after that, Rebecca Dawson's husband went and kind of beat up this person who had led the tour. And so after her husband was arrested, Rebecca Dawson, who wore a full face veil, completely veiled, so only her eyes were visible, and accompanied by her brother, went to the Finsbury Park Mosque in search of the caretaker. She then found this guy and then threatened him with dire consequences if he was going to testify against her husband in the assault case. The caretaker, you know, went and complained again to the police, and Rebecca Dawson herself, still wearing her full face veil, was arrested and then charged with one count of intimidation of a potential witness. And so I wanted to kind of present, and then of course, you know, scene two of this is that her case comes up to for a hearing at Blackfriars, at the court, and, you know, she refuses to remove her full face veil. And the only time that, so they essentially had to take her into a room off to the side, you know, to affirm that she actually was Rebecca Dawson. This person was Rebecca Dawson, but then she put it right back on. But then, you know, once she came back, the judge didn't feel like they could have a trial with her wearing this full face veil. And then, so he orders a stay on the trial, you know, on like considering whether or not a defendant could be compelled to remove the face veil while being tried for intimidation in a criminal trial. And then he also, you know, commissioned this expert report. You know, like the report itself is, you know, the expert said that she had the right to wear, you know, because it was part of her religious belief, she had the right to wear this face veil in court. But the judge dismissed that premise and said that he goes on into kind of like this meandering judgment, but he dismisses the idea, the fact, and, you know, in the end, of course, like comes up with like a law to justify it. But, you know, the point of the case, of course, is like the central irony, right? Is that here's a woman that's charged with intimidation of a witness, but you can't see her face. And you know, she's fighting to keep this face veil on in court. But the idea that you can intimidate someone without your identity even being obvious is a very kind of an idea that isn't usually considered. And it represents, I think, a lot of interesting things. First, of course, it upends this idea that, you know, wearing that full face veil, as you know, there's all these connections drawn, of course, with Afghanistan and Taliban, and these pictures of fully veiled women as eternally repressed. And then you have a woman wearing the almost exact same sort of garment who's charged with intimidation. And then, you know, the judge kind of doesn't know how to make her take this off. And he's upset and he kind of is blaming multiculturalism and too much tolerance and all of that for the fact that she's insisting on wearing this. And so, first of all, I mean, you see the contextual difference. And of course, the other is that it depends on what the person is doing. So, you know, you can't have like a blanket meaning attached to the veil. And, but then, you know, this kind of other interpretation of the veil as, you know, veiled women as being intimidating is now being developed more within cultures, Western culture, because it provides an argument to force women to take off the veil. So, you know, it's sort of ridiculous because, you know, on one end, you're sending armies out to all these Muslim countries, and, you know, the very, very kind of visible reasons are, I mean, for, you know, I think I mentioned it in the book, for instance, before the invasion of Afghanistan, the Carolyn Maloney, a congresswoman from New York, wore a full burqa on the House of Representatives floor in Washington, D.C., to show how, you know, and she's like, I can't even breathe under this thing, and it's so repressive. And then after that, she distributed these pins with shreds of that blue burqa among people to kind of drum up support for the Afghan war. So, you know, on one hand, you've got that. And then on the other side, you're kind of forcing. So on one hand, you're saying you're going to like vanquish the people who force women to wear veils. But then within sort of Western societies, it's the other way where we're going to force women to take off their veils. So, you know, I mean, the kind of central mechanism there isn't really what the women want. It's what the men want women to do, by and large. And I think Rebecca's case really kind of illustrated that. It illustrated this question of intimidation and repression as it relates to this object and the fact that, you know, you wear it and suddenly there's a different meaning to your encounter with people than if you weren't wearing it.
Now, in another chapter, you frame it in the sense of feminism, but what you do in the chapter is kind of look at how veiling in a kind of personal way also extends to veiled spaces or inaccessible spaces in a way. And this then is framed in the discourse of kind of the Western legitimation of conquest and domination and ultimately colonization in many ways. Can you talk a little bit about how these discourses of liberation or freedom are put to use in support of unveiling in the sense of kind of entrance or presence or even violence?
Yes. I mean, you know, obviously the more recent and more popularly known example is the examples that I give of the invasion of Afghanistan and the Taliban and the burqa or the veil in relation to that. But, you know, I wanted to dig around and kind of connect that to a longer history of sort of this idea and how much, you know, kind of Western colonialism was dependent on this idea of kind of penetrating the innermost confines of the Muslim countries where the French or the British essentially invaded and occupied. And one of the books that I talk about at length in that chapter is, Malik Alula's book of photographs of Algerian women during the French occupation of Algeria. And gosh, I cannot recommend the book enough to people who study the veil or Muslim women, because in the photographs, there is this sort of progression in which, you know, women, and I mean, of course, it's not just Alula's photographs. I give examples, other examples from Western art that showed this similar kind of obsession with penetrating the veil, you know, penetrating the harem, penetrating and being present. In Alula's book, of course, the book starts out with veiled pictures, photographs of veiled women as they're out in public space or walking or, you know, and then there's like this sort of a progression to showing women with their faces uncovered, and it ultimately ends to this with these pictures of women who have their breasts uncovered, who are completely exposed, and those last photographs represent, you know, the sort of when that occupation was complete, and French soldiers were paying these women so that they could take their pictures like that for souvenirs. And so it's kind of shows this sort of expansion of control until there is this ultimate exposure. The other painting that I talk about is Delacroix's Femmes Algériennes. And, I encourage everyone to Google that painting or an image of that painting, because once again, it kind of, it's a scene, supposedly a scene from inside a harem. And its presentation kind of represents, you know, the painter is present within the action of the hand. So it just kind of shows, it signifies, you know, for it, particularly for those people who are, who have experienced colonialism, is that, you know, there is now a presence, the foreign presence is now in the deepest, you know, spaces, most private spaces of the societies in which, which colonial expansion was taking place. And, you know, it's not a perspective, I think, that people are used to thinking about, because you sort of envision photographs or paintings as you kind of imagine the photographer or the painter as invisible, right? But someone has to be present within these spaces to take these pictures, and that continues to be a preoccupation. You know, I mean, I then have an example from Rod Nordland's book, The New York Times. He was the New York Times correspondent from Afghanistan for a very long time. And his book, about this Afghan couple called The Lovers. It came out like a couple of years ago, I think. And, you know, it's very self-consciously talks about how his photographer needed photographs of this woman, of the girl, that is the subject of the book and that had been the subject of articles before. And you know, she kind of retreats to the female area of the house and isn't coming out. And the photographer is getting very frustrated that he can't get this picture that he wants and he needs for his article or for the article. And he just pretends not to understand anybody else that's around him, not to understand English, because it's been communicated that she's in there and she doesn't want to come out. And he just kind of barges in and goes in and takes his pictures. And the fact that, you know, the incident was reported without any self-consciousness or any apologetics in the book is so striking to me and should, I think, be striking to everybody who reads it, because it shows the same sort of mentality and disrespect of these spaces that have a very particular meaning and that this girl had been relying on for some privacy. And it sort of shows that, okay, your stories and your pictures and access to you is, you know, we're entitled to that access and you have to give it up. And, you know, and in that case, of course, she does give it up. You know, the pictures are taken and they're in the New York Times. So whether she wants it, likes it or not. And so, you know, that's where we are today. And it's sort of difficult to say whether there has been any progress from the post, the Femmes Algériennes, or from Malik Alula's, you know, the picture, the photographs and postcards that he shows in his book of Algerian women who are, you know, ultimately completely exposed to these French soldiers. And I mean, you know, I guess until we connect those and we give what's happening now in relation to the veil and occupation and colonialism a genealogy, it seems like an instance or a political debate that is centered in the present and that doesn't have a past. And that's simply not true.
Now, there's so much more to this book. We could talk for a whole nother hour. I'm wondering if there's any kind of last or kind of central thoughts that you want listeners and hopefully potential readers to take away before I let you go.
Well, buy the book.
That's all you need to know, right?
Yes, that would be, that would be my last thought. But yeah, I mean, I would like to add that, this is a book that's written for people who are interested or people who are just coming to the topic. And, I definitely I've taught myself issues surrounding the veil. And, I wanted a book that kind of could be a good introductory text for students and for other people who are interested in the topic without kind of overwhelming them with just kind of the jurisprudential kind of interpretations of this or that edict and about the veil and wearing the veil. This is that kind of book. I wanted a mix of personal experience so that people can see that this is something that affects people in their lives, and it's it does exist at this intersection of politics and culture and history, and then centrally personal experience, and then there's sort of an alchemy to all of those that kind of comes together in the meaning that you attach to the veil. So if you're interested in exploring those dimensions, I'd say take a look, take a read.
Now, Rafia, could you tell us a little bit about the types of things you foresee in the future in terms of your writing?
I'm working on another book that is kind of more centrally about ideas of culture and tradition. I mean, it's a memoir like my first book, and I guess in some ways Veil is also at least partially a memoir. So this book explores these ideas of kind of the central question is my relationship to my own mother and kind of her very traditional life as a homemaker and a mother and a housewife, and growing up within that and then wanting a very different life that was engaged politically and within these larger debates, and how that relationship changed, and how, there's there's a sort of comfort in doing and familiarity in kind of doing what your mother has done. And then there is this drive to rebel and have a different life. So the book is called A Different Life. And that's my big project right now.
Great. Well, good luck on that. And thanks for making the time to talk about this wonderful book.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Rafia Zakaria about her wonderful new book, Veil, published in Bloomsbury's Object Lessons series, published in 2017.